This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. It's Halloween, which means we're going to talk about one of the scariest things out there, your taxes. Joining us in studio to talk about tax reform and a number of other things this segment of Forum is Steve Forbes. He's editor-in-chief and chairman of Forbes Media, which publishes Forbes magazine. He made tax reform the center of his Republican bid for the presidential nomination back in 1996 and 2000. He's also the author of the book Reviving America, How Repealing Obamacare, Replacing the Tax Code, and Reforming the Fed Will Restore Hope and Prosperity. And welcome back to Forum, Steve Forbes.
Good to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Good to have you here. And I guess the place to begin is with a couple of congratulations. You've reached the 100-year mark. I know you're now a septuagenarian. It's Halloween. You can go trick-or-treating because I know you're eating a lot more sweets. But let's talk about flat tax first, because I think a lot of our listeners may have no idea. I mean, you will be forever identified with a flat tax proposal. 40 countries now, essentially, including Hong Kong, have your tax proposal, your flat tax proposal, in operation.
Yes, they do. And essentially what the flat tax does is take the current code, which is now, when you take all the attendant opinions and everything else, over 10 million words, and junk the whole thing, have a single rate, generous exemptions for adults and for kids. For example, a family of four would pay no federal income tax on their first $52,800 of salary. There'd be no tax on your savings and no death tax. Do the same thing on the corporate side, business side. And above your $52,000, you'd only pay 17 cents on the dollar. So that way you clean the whole thing out. You could literally do your tax return on a single sheet of paper, a few keystrokes on a computer. And I think it's also, Michael, a moral issue. The IRS estimates we spend 6 billion hours a year filling out tax forms. And we spend, experts estimate, that $200 to $300 billion a year complying with this monstrosity. So if you go back 20 years, take all those tens of billions of hours, literally trillions of dollars, immense brain power, and just fantasize for a moment if all of that had gone for new products, new services, new cures for diseases, new medical devices, how much better off we'd be instead of this huge waste and a corrupt thing that nobody understands.
Well, we're going to get a tax proposal. I don't know that it's going to be a Steve Forbes type of tax proposal.
But we can... on a scale of 100, it'll be about 3.
Well, you were recently in San Diego, I know. You were talking a lot about education reform and workforce skills gap to Ashford University. But you also got into tax reform, and you said the thing from, and you know, you're a longtime Republican, and you said they should be doing, and that is the GOP now with control in Congress, should be doing what Ronald Reagan did and what, for that matter, JFK did, big, fat tax cut across the board.
That's right. Do it from top to bottom. You want people to have keep more of what they earn. But
and then, forgive me, reform later. I mean,
I don't know why the Republicans use the word reform. It doesn't say anything to anybody. Tax cuts, people understand. The Republicans have a messaging problem. But getting to what we're talking about in San Diego, what Kennedy did, John Kennedy, and what Ronald Reagan did, was recognize you need to enable people to keep more of what they earn, but also have more investment so you get better jobs, higher pays in the future. So you just, it's not just a one-time increase in pay, nice though that would be. You know, in the future, you have the prospect of real raises, and Lincoln put it, improving your lot in life. So instead of trying to do the tinkering around with the code now, forget about state and local taxes. Forget about that stuff. It's too late. Just go for a 20% across-the-board cut, and to make sure that everyone gets a tax cut, and this is something the Republicans haven't really even seriously considered, is, you know, a lot of people don't pay income tax, but everyone who works pays payroll taxes on your Social Security. So why not do what we did 6 years ago under President Obama, and that is your first they did 2 points on your Social Security tax, they wouldn't tax you anymore. Do 3 or 4 points. So if you're making, say, $15,000 a year, you're going to get a $600 raise. So everyone, whether you pay income tax or not, is going to get a raise in their pay. Basic things like that. Make it simple across the board. Make sure everyone gets a break, and watch the economy really blossom.
Well, let me ask you a political question appended onto that. President Trump now has had the shadow of the Mueller investigation with the first indictment and the essential deal that was worked out with somebody who was a part of his campaign. if you look back historically, you realize that Bill Clinton couldn't do much when the Lewinsky story broke, and Bush Sr. couldn't do much when the Iran-Contra story broke. The timing was bad, even though they had legislatures of their own party. I'm wondering to what extent this might be the case now with tax, what they're calling, as you say, tax reform. And particularly, I need to ask you, should Republicans in Congress, because you're talking about what Republicans are wanting and maybe need to step up and message better, should they be more vocally supportive of the Mueller or Mueller investigation?
Well, that thing is going to play out, and as we've seen in the headlines, this is meshing everyone. So you're going to have Mueller's investigation, the special counsel's investigation. You also have numerous congressional investigations. So who knows where that's all going to lead? But right now, the economy is the most immediate thing. Taxes are the most immediate thing. And on the Republican side, I think we will get a tax bill. How good it is, I'm not sure. But because of what biologists call the instinct of self-preservation. The Republicans are beginning to wake up to the fact we have elections next year. And if they don't get this economy really humming in a way that people really feel it, as we did in the 80s and 90s or back in the 1960s, a lot of these Republicans are perhaps going to have to pursue new opportunities. And I don't think too many of them want to become Uber drivers or whatever else is out there. So I think they're going to get off their duffs and at least pass something. But
well, they're saying, for example,
better.
They're going to double exemptions. They're going to do so much for the middle class. I mean, a lot of this sounds pie in the sky because when you look at it, it's got a huge deficit, although the details have not been worked out. But it's also got within it pretty disturbing kinds of notions that essentially are not necessarily going to help the middle class. They're going to help mainly the affluent.
Well, that's the thing. These guys should stop worshiping this thing they call the Congressional Budget Office, which purports to tell us what's going to happen 10 years down the road. If you can tell me what's going to happen in the stock market 10 days down the road, do it. These guys, if they could predict the future, wouldn't be working for the CBO.
Would you say the CBO is to them like Vestal Virgins or something along those
lines? Yeah, but not even as good. At least Vestal Virgins danced around when they made their projections that never worked out. But in the case of the Republicans, forget about fooling around with 401ks and IRAs. Stop it. Stop talking about a fourth bracket. Stop talking about putting on a 20% national sales tax, border tax, all these ridiculous things, and just go for a straight tax cut. And if you want to clean the code, I've suggested ways to do it. Others have. Do it in a year or two. But right now, get a big fat tax cut like Reagan did, Kennedy did, get the economy moving, and they'll have some political capital to do serious changes.
Does that mean growth? Is that a certainty in your mind that means growth? And it's also a certainty that it's going to be a job creator, as we keep hearing tax cuts.
When you get a boom in investment, when people know they keep more of what they earn, their pay is going up, yes, you get a booming economy. Again, we've seen this in the past, in the 60s, 80s, much of the 90s. When you get off the backs of people and encourage investment, encourage people to be earning more, and they get to earn more, keep more of what they earn, then by golly, the economy booms. But history doesn't seem to be taught anymore.
Talking with Steve Forbes, one of the few among us who still uses that phrase, by golly, he is chairman and editor-in-chief of Forbes Media, also author of Reviving America.
By the way, you talked about 100th. My young grandson, I had to tell him the difference between that Forbes magazine's 100. His grandfather's only 70. But to young kids, we all look the same.
Well, your grandfather was quite an extraordinary man, and that story has been inspiring in many ways, I know, for you and for many, because you've told it to many. It's kind of an American dream story. I think when I read what you write and when I hear what you say, you're still a firm and ardent believer in that, aren't you?
Absolutely. What we today call entrepreneurial capitalism, but in the first issue of the magazine, my grandfather was an immigrant to this country, one of 10 children, grade school education, but like many who came here and still coming here today has dreams and ambitions.
Who volunteered to work for no pay. Do I have that right?
You bet. When he came here, got off the boat in New York, he wanted to be a business writer, had some experience, but no editor would hire him. So finally, having that entrepreneurial mind, he went to one, I guess you could do it in those days, and said, I'll offer to work for you for free, show you my worth, and hopefully if I do, you'll hire me. Now, he had no idea whether the editor would just take his free labor and then toss him out on the sidewalk, but he knew if he just continued to say, give me a job, it's not going to work. So he did something unusual. He got the job, but he had so much energy and ambition, he went to another editor, used a different name, got a job there, and probably one of the most happiest moments in his life was when the two editors got into an argument as to who had the best business writers, my grandfather in both cases.
We're talking again with Steve Forbes, and we're talking taxes for the most part, but a number of other things. He often has his hand on many pulses, and I want to ask him particularly about a number of other things. But I also want to hear from you, our listeners, and let me invite you to join us now. Our toll-free number is available. You can join us forthwith. The number to call is 866-733-6786, and the time to call, if you have a question or comment for our guest, Steve Forbes, would be now. Again, 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and simply click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and you can also, of course, go to our Facebook page. Got to ask you, though, because you've said such really salutary and positive things about Betsy DeVos and Scott Pruitt, and listeners out here would not necessarily agree with those, shall we say, laudatory remarks about both of those cabinet members. I would say probably a disproportionate number of my listeners. What do you see as really golden about the, because obviously you're very, how shall we say, bullish on both of those cabinet members.
Well, in education, I think the idea that parents should have only one choice is morally wrong. We're not all the same. We're finding out that the one teaching method that works with one kid may not work very well with another. So giving parents the opportunity to choose the instruction, choose the schools that best meet the needs of their particular kids, to me seems very American instead of one size fits all. And on the environmental side, I think instead of either we're going to pollute the earth or not pollute the earth, a little common sense will go a long ways. And I think when you look back, even though people wouldn't recognize in the last 40 or 50 years, we've made immense progress. I mean, when I was growing up, when you were growing up, lead in the air was normal, which was absolutely astounding today. We did something about it, cleaned up a lot of lakes, and so the air in Los Angeles. I know I'm not supposed to mention that town here, but when you went to L.A. in the 50s, 60s, your eyes would burn because of the when the pollution built up. Because
we just did a program recently, though, about how toxics have, shall we say, not under the present administration, under Pruitt, and there are all kinds of things we could go into about EPA that are disturbing to many, but since we just did a program on it, I'd like you to comment. There's an attempt to deregulate and deregulate to the point where there may be a lot more toxics out there for consumers to buy and not necessarily get past the litmus tests that are necessary.
The fact of the matter is we're not going to have a situation where suddenly you're going to buy a piece of meat and find out that it's tainted like 1906 and when Upton Sinclair wrote his book about meat packers in those days. Not going to happen. What we're trying to get is rules and regulations that give safer products, make the air cleaner, as we've done over the years, but also do it in a way that doesn't crush the economy. The two are not contradictory. One of the things that I think we went off a little astray when we started to realize we had to clean up the environment was the tendency to tell everyone how to do it instead of saying, here are the goals. Here's what we want in 5 years or 7 years. You come up with a good best way to do it instead of this top-down approach. So the goal is when a society becomes richer, it wants a higher quality of life, not just in terms of a paycheck, but in terms of what they see, the air they breathe. So the question is how you best do it without crushing the economy. And the nice thing is even in places like China, even though the government's very authoritarian, people have made it clear, sadly they have to do it through riots, that they want the air cleaned up. If you want to see bad air, just go to even Beijing. I first went there 40 years ago when it was just opening up. You knew when you came back from Beijing you'd have a hack called the Beijing hack from the coal, the dust coming in from the desert. So China's got a long ways to go on
that. Yeah, but ironically, China's become an energy leader, some would argue, and one of them would be Senator George Mitchell, who's joining us in the hour next, who argues that because we dropped out of the Paris Accords, now China has taken an advance in terms of, I mean, they may have been behind as a third world power for years, but they certainly, in terms of climate change now with this administration, have far surpassed us in trying to move toward doing things about climate change.
Well, on the Paris Accord, they and India were given a bye till 2030. and we're the only ones, one of the only major countries that have reduced our carbon dioxide.
So you think it was smart of President Trump to drop out of that?
I think what he is saying is we got a bad deal. If you want to renegotiate it where China and India actually have to do something before 2030, good.
C. Forbes with us in studio, chair and editor-in-chief of Forbes Media, author of Reviving America, How Repealing Obamacare, Replacing the Tax Code, and Reforming the Fed Will Restore Hope and Prosperity. Sounds like a lot, but this is a man who is a believer, and let's find out what you, our listeners, have to say to him or ask him. And we go, first of all, to San Jose and welcome Lisa. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. So, Mr. Forbes, yes, music to my ears, tax cut across the board, tax code reform down the line, I love it, but I think that there's an issue that hasn't been discussed, which is there needs to be a change in the philosophy of employers so that there's a two-way commitment when somebody's hired. Right now, I think I'm in the Bay Area. Employees are considered dispensable. We get laid off every 1 to 2 years as companies do well or don't do well. And I know in terms of spending and the economy, my family will hold off. We don't spend because we never know when the next layoff is going to come, and we feel we need to have that money in the bank.
Yeah, an important point, Lisa, and I thank you for it. Let's go to Steve Forbes and hear what he has to say.
Thank you, Lisa. And the idea of saving for a rainy day because of all the uncertainty out there is a wise thing to do. But in terms of making sure that people who want to get out in the workforce have an opportunity and are desired, instead of knocking on the door, they're knocking on your door, that's why we want a booming economy. Back in the 1980s, late 1990s, or even the late 1960s, people were competing for labor. Companies were training people, not of altruism, but because they needed the skilled workers. So that's the kind of environment we need, where they need you more almost than you need them. And we've had those periods before, and that's why I think starting with taxes, we can get it again. There are a lot of other things that have to be done. But if we get a good John F. Kennedy, Ronald Reagan kind of a tax package, that would be a good start so that they come knocking on your door.
And thank you, Lisa, for the call. We'll get more calls on here in a moment, but here's a question from a listener on our email.
Oh, by the way, just on that, Lisa's point, in terms of when there's a skills gap in this country, there are literally 250,000 jobs in areas like construction, in areas like HVAC, where they're good, very good paying jobs going crying because people aren't trained to do them. And those jobs, a few years, you're earning $100,000, $120,000 a year. Good stuff. So we got to make sure that people have the opportunity. There are gaps out there that right now, today, you start training for that, you've got a good, pretty good future.
Listener wants to know if you support the end of mortgage tax deduction.
The answer is not unless you do the flat tax where you get a big tax cut. And we do away with all exemptions. And by the way, Michael, on the flat tax, because people get concerned, even if you show them that they're going to keep more of what they earn when you clean out the code. People are rightly skeptical. So we do a variation of what Hong Kong does. That is, give you a choice. See for yourself which is better, the flat tax or the current monstrosity we have today. That way, people won't get hung up. Am I going to lose this? I'm going to lose that. See for yourself. I think 99% would realize the new is better, but you don't have to take my word for it.
How about your word on hedge funds being taxed?
Again, nice thing about the flat tax is it all goes by the boards. They'd be paying what everyone else is paying.
And we'll get some more of your callers on, and we go next to Damien. You're on the air. Good morning. Join us.
Good morning, Mr. Forbes. Good morning, Mike. My question is this. I don't believe that tax cuts, as they have maybe in the past, related to the economy. Our economy is going strong right now because of, A, the easy ability to transfer money around the world to invest in other markets. Two, automation already is expected by 27% of simple manual data collecting jobs will be gone that will not be replaced. So I just don't see how this tax cut, this great halo tax cut, is really going to make any difference. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Damien. And the nice thing, though, is when you have a good environment, a good tax environment, good regulatory environment, people come up with new things we couldn't even dream of today. Let me just give you some quick historic examples. After World War II, one of the biggest employers in this country was the nation's railroads, 1.2 million people. Today, railroads employ about 170,000, 180,000 people, carry 10 times as much freight. You look at what we used to call telephones, hundreds of thousands of operators, all those jobs gone. When you have a vibrant economy, you shed old jobs and create new jobs. The problem we have today is with the slow growth we've had here and around the world is we're not creating the new opportunities. And the fear about robotics is we always have what we used to call labor-saving devices coming along. For example, in terms of labor-saving devices, go to online and get a picture of what they used to call a washer board, where people would have, especially women, have to rub clothes on this thing to try to get the dirt out. A robot came along. We didn't realize it was a robot because it didn't look like one. It was a washing machine. And you see it with dishwashers. One of the biggest robots in history was the invention of the tractor, which freed up literally tens of millions of acres of land that grew forage for farm animals, which is where you got the power in those days, freed it up for everything from forest development, growing more food. And so these things are constantly happening. But the key thing is you want an economy where new and better things are coming along. What things will emerge? If I knew that, I wouldn't be here. I'd be out doing it. But they always do when people are allowed to be creative, like you see in the Valley.
Well, let me ask you about a couple that are emerging. I mean, artificial intelligence is emerging and, in fact, burgeoning. And so is that all kinds of research in genetic editing. I mean, and people are afraid of both of those things.
Yes. Well, when something brand new comes along, that's how we got the character of Frankenstein, electricity and things like that. But in terms of artificial intelligence, and again, we've had variations of that for years with your handheld. The memory you hold in your hand today, I mean, if you said 25 years ago your grandmother could operate a supercomputer, you'd think you'd be nuts. But today, Granny and everyone else, and I'm in that category, I'm in my 70s, so I know that Appalachia, Grandpa, Grandma. But in a handheld, I, who know nothing about technology, can operate what was an effective a few couple of decades ago, a supercomputer. So artificial intelligence just means we don't have to memorize a lot of things. They'll memorize it for us, and we can focus our minds on what we call more value-added things. Now, in terms of genetics, there we do need some real rules of the road, where it's one thing to fight a disease in a baby who's not born yet, where you can see there's a problem here, we can do it already. Now you are able to do surgeries during a pregnancy if it looks like there's a problem, physical problem there. So, but you also don't want, you have to have rules, real laws that, and this is where it's not just laws, it's the moral basis of society. There's certain things that are just totally out of bounds, and if you cross the line on that, not only society condemns you, but you're going to get a long life and what somebody once called gated communities run by the government, i.e. prison.
Talking to Steve Forbes, chair and editor-in-chief of Forbes Media, author of Reviving America. Derek wants to know, how do you feel about the carbon tax?
Carbon tax, well, tax is not part of my vocabulary. I'm out to remove taxes, not increase them. So the problem is when they put these new taxes on, they say, oh, this will do all this good stuff. All it means is you end up having less. So if you want to clean up the tax code, federal tax code, and cut people's taxes a lot, then maybe people will be in a mood to hear about new ways to pick their pockets. But let's first let you keep more of what you earn and let you earn more.
I'm looking at another listener comment. It says, according to David K. Johnson, we need more tax brackets, not fewer, for better tax equity.
Well, tax equity means, in essence, that the government owns everything you own, and anything they allow you to keep, they call a tax expenditure. So, this is a case in taxes where less is more. Just going back in history, and I know I shouldn't use numbers, but before Reagan cut taxes, the top 1% paid 18% of federal income taxes. Today, they pay about 38 or 40%. The top 10%, 70%. Top 20% earners in this country, 95%. So that's why, getting back to what we were discussing earlier, Michael, in terms of what the Republicans are going to do on tax cuts, yes, by all means, you want to double the exemption. Instead of saying double the exemption, people don't know what that means, is just say a couple is going to keep their first $24,000 free of federal income tax. We go all get that. Messaging again. But all that is good. But also do the Social Security thing so that everyone, whether they pay federal income tax or not, gets a break and gets to keep more.
Republicans are saying essentially they're going to fight to get down the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20 or 25. You'd like it even lower, I presume.
Yes, I'd propose in my thing 17. And now they're talking about a 3-year phase-in, and which is ridiculous because all that does is create uncertainty. Will you get the second year? Will you get the third year? Just do it. That's what these people have to realize. There's no half pregnancy. Either do it right or don't bother. Just cut it and be done with it. And by the way, that'll be good for the economy. One of the key things that enabled Ireland over the years to go from the poorest country in Western Europe to the most dynamic economy was they precisely removed those business taxes. Theirs is 12.5%. Ours is at 35%. And the European community is always on their backs. Oh, it's too low. It's too low. Even in the crisis of 2008, Ireland said, no, we're not going to change it, even though they're under pressure to do it. So even though Ireland was slammed hard by the crisis of 2008, they've come back magnificently. They have a very high growth rate.
Well, Ireland is always mentioned by folks who are sympathetic to your point of view about cutting. And
Hong Kong, Singapore.
Well, but here's...
Even England now.
Here's Kansas also
Canada.
Comes up. I want to get your response
to
this. Alan writes, Kansas gave, and he's right, nice big fat tax cuts, and now the state is horribly in debt and services have been cut drastically. Job growth is lower than in surrounding states. Republican legislators are saying they made a mistake. Why would tax cuts at the national level be different?
Well, first, tax cuts work. What happened in the state of Kansas, and for every Kansas I can cite you, six other states where it worked magnificently. When they put that in 2011-2012, Kansas was hit by an enormous collapse of commodity prices and energy prices, two critical industries. But if you look at the whole picture, even as those two traditional industries got slammed in Kansas, businesses were moving across the border from Missouri into Kansas to take advantage of the better environment. And so if you have a good tax regime, what it means is you're not, it doesn't mean you're not going to have downturns. What it means is you're going to recover faster. Take the state, for example, the state of New Hampshire in the early 90s, really hit hard, not only by the recession, but by the drastic cutback in defense spending. It was a big part of the New Hampshire economy. They were flat on their backs, which is why Pat Buchanan nearly beat the sitting president of the United States, George H.W. Bush, in the New Hampshire primary. New Hampshire was suffering. But New Hampshire didn't change its tax regime, and as a result, New Hampshire recovered very quickly. And today, its economy is booming, much better than neighboring states like Vermont and Maine.
Let me get you on here quickly, Charles, because he wants to talk about that Bush senior tax cut. Go ahead, Charles. Quickly, if you could.
For taking my call. My observation was that when George H.W. Bush raised taxes and lost the election, but he also put in place our very first tax surplus.
Is that true, Steve Forbes, from your perspective?
No, that actually hurt his reelections because it hurt the economy.
And because he said, read my lips, and he didn't.
And you make a break a big promise like that and it doesn't work, you pay the price for it.
Steve Forbes will be at the Commonwealth Club today at noon. Good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
And congratulations on the 100-year anniversary, by
Thank
the way.
Thank you.
Up ahead, former Senator George Mitchell, peacemaker in Northern Ireland and trying to make peace in the Middle East under the Obama administration. Stay tuned for that. It's up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.